Is Richard Dean Winfield.
Today we have the pleasure of being joined by Stephen Rothstein of Ceres organization. This is a not-for-profit organization that insists that companies in America today should be focusing on what climate change means for them, for their bottom line, for potential profits, and the future of what business can do for possibly rectifying climate change and reorienting business plan strategies and so forth, at least to the extent that I've been able to look into it. It looks like a quite generous and noble cause. Of course, we talk about climate change on our podcast. But Stephen, it's great for you to be here. Could you maybe outline some of the more specific details of what Ceres does?
Sure. Thank you, both of you, for this and for all the great work and sharing so much valuable information with your listeners. So Ceres, it's based in Boston, but it operates all over. And it's been around for over 30 years. As you say, it's a nonprofit. And there's four main things. The first is that it does. First is working with investors. So large investors that want to move their portfolio to become more sustainable. Our investors collectively have about $31 trillion of assets under management. And so we work with them, again, mostly large ones, but some medium-sized investors as well. The second big bucket of our work is with major companies. And we work with them from the boardroom to the supply chain and helping them to become more sustainable and work with all industries across all throughout the country. Third is on policy in various states and in Washington policy. And the fourth is I run a group called the Ceres Accelerator for sustainable capital markets, and we try to make our markets, our capital markets, more sustainable for the long term.
That's fantastic. I mean, given the state of the crisis that we're under when it comes to climate change. Richard, as a recent candidate, somebody outwardly spoken about the crisis of climate change, could you maybe outline your position on what some of the basics of what you believe need the some of the intro steps to what climate change means for both maybe the people of Georgia and America, and from a political sense, what does the why does it matter?
Well, look, I think we all know that we are facing a climate crisis that is bearing down on us. And we're also at, I think, a hopeful turning point in American political history with the farewell to Trump, which I hope will be a permanent farewell, and the arrival of a new administration that is committed to probably the most ambitious climate mitigation platform of any president, where at least if you go to the party platform, I mean, Biden was endorsing a goal of achieving basic carbon neutrality by 2050. And he has immediately, of course, put us back in the Paris Climate Agreements. He's canceled plans to build fossil fuel pipelines, ending exploration on federal lands and the like. And, I'm looking forward to seeing what he will do. Of course, he's also removing the decrease in mileage standards for automobiles and the like. So I think we're at a time where, with Democratic control of the presidency and the two houses of Congress, where it's possible for the government to make the kind of policy changes that can create an environment for business to make the transition to a clean economy and to do so in a way that will not undermine or endanger anyone's livelihoods. But I think it's also very important to keep in mind that the United States now, although it is the greatest contributor to greenhouse gases historically, now contributes about 15% of the world total. And obviously, to solve or mitigate the climate crisis we're facing, we not only have to take bold action nationally, involving both the public and private sectors, but also internationally. And that's particularly true in view of the fact that, you know, the United States is now falling under 20% of the world's economic activity, and that will continue to decline as nations like China and India continue to expand their economies. And they need to expand their energy for their mammoth populations to ensure that their livelihoods can reach the levels of the more affluent nations. And although they are both committed to very ambitious goals of clean energy, they are also at the same time expanding their coal production and other fossil fuel energy components to a tremendous degree. And I think in all of our policies, we really have to think of ways in which we can do things domestically and also internationally to ensure that the energy needs of the world are met without creating an economic catastrophe and also undermining the livelihoods of millions of people throughout the world. And those who will suffer the most are, frankly, in that part of the world that is less affluent. And I'm interested to hear what Stephen has to say about the actual financial threat that climate change is presenting to us, and what impact that has in dealing with strategies for public regulation of private activity.
Right. I think first you make a lot of important points, and the financial issues are very real. They're real today, and they're growing every day. Basically, there are lots of evidence, literally hundreds and hundreds of studies that show the risk that we have is growing. And it's growing in a few ways. First is there's physical risk, floods, fires, earthquakes, tornadoes, droughts, things that affect where you are physically. And you know, we have, for example, in 2020, we had 10 times the amount of acres burned that we did in 2019. It was tied with the hottest year on record, and we had a lot less economic activity because a lot of people worked from home. We had 30 named hurricanes, more than any time in several years. So it's getting worse. The second is there is transition risk. When, as we transition to a lower carbon economy, there will be stranded costs. There'll be money that companies have invested that they won't be able to return. And that will affect their shareholders, their investors, their banks, their insurance companies. Just in the first 9 months of 2020, oil companies wrote off about $150 billion of assets. So these risks of physical risks, of transition risks, of liability risks, of public reputational risks are here with us today, and they're growing. And we've had lots of conversations with banks and with regulators, both state and federal bank regulators, insurance regulators, Federal Reserve, and others about this. And their job as regulators need to think about risks, and we believe climate is one of those risks they need to address.
As of now, the markets seem to be greatly reliant on what would be fossil fuel industry, one of the biggest and worst climate change contributors. In what ways do you see the ability to wean off of this financially? Because it also sort of affects a lot of banks and institutions, economies, a runoff of energy.
Yeah, so first, if someone had invested 10 years ago and their portfolio was a mixed portfolio of the stock market and included the fossil fuel industry, versus if it didn't include the fossil fuel industry, you would have done a lot worse to be investing in the fossil fuel industry. It lost a lot of value, reduced jobs, and wrote off, as I say, hundreds of billions of dollars. So there's already a loss. Second thing is we're seeing, you know, today the largest energy company Exxon's no longer in the top tier. And they're not even the largest energy company. Now a solar company is. We have Tesla that has a market value of, you know, several other auto companies combined. So we're seeing lots of growth opportunities in green, renewable, energy, water savings, and other things. Second is there's a growing demand for this. We saw more money being invested in ESG funds, funds that think about environment, society, and government, ESG, in 2020 than ever before, in large numbers. So there is growing demand for it. And we're working with banks to establish what's called net zero by 2040 or net zero by 2050 plans, meaning that they're set an objective and work towards it. So it's not overnight, but it's over time, because their job is to maintain their profitability and their customers and things like that. But that there are banks that have already taken the lead to decarbonize their portfolio. I'll give you one example. About two or three months ago, the former administration tried to issue an RFP for drilling in the Arctic, and no major oil company applied. And that's a combination of the economic realities, the reputational realities, and political realities that they knew the risks that they have. So we think that risks are risks, and that the banks and the financial institutions need to reduce their exposure, not just because it's good for the environment, which it is, but it's also good for their financial stability. There is more risk today in bank balance sheets for climate-related issues, more risk, than there was in 2007 and 8 on subprime housing before the housing crash.
Now, of course, when you bring up housing, part of the climate risks involve destructions of huge amounts of housing due to wildfires, such as we've seen in many parts of the United States and other countries, and also, of course, increased storms activity, destroying much housing, as well as increasing flooding in low-lying areas. And obviously, this is a huge threat to the insurance industry that's covering such housing. And of course, there's a question of whether we want to have public policy that will allow people to rebuild in areas that are becoming more and more prone to these kind of difficulties that are not going to be eliminated in the near future, and may just get worse, even if we were to achieve carbon neutrality by 2050, let alone 2040. So how do you see ways of dealing with that huge exposure, which is going to be a problem, is a problem for insurance companies, and of course is a problem for the people who will be losing their houses, and the businesses that will lose their infrastructure?
Absolutely, it's an enormous problem. First is it's a problem like many other problems in our society. It's a problem that disproportionately affects low and moderate income individuals. If you look at some of the major storms from Katrina to many others, that folks, whether it be because they don't have any savings, they can't go someplace else, they don't have transportation, a whole variety of factors. So they are the most affected with all of these issues. Climate justice, environmental justice is racial justice, and racial justice is climate justice. So it affects the group that is disadvantaged first and most predominantly. Second is it does affect all of us, and we as both insurance holders but also as taxpayers, because we have the National Flood Insurance Program that is woefully underfunded and the maps they're using is woefully out of date. So there are a variety of things we need to do, but one of the ideas that I think needs further exploration is, instead of rebuilding over and over again, maybe we as a government say to people, you know, if their house has been destroyed, we will give you blank dollars. But if you decide to build here again, we're not going to do it again. We're only going to do it once. So we let people make a decision, but we try to steer them in a direction of another place. And there are lots of areas, again, from updating the maps that we're using, the flood risks, there is tens of millions of homes that are really under those risks that aren't reflected in the maps. It's looking at the public areas, but it's also looking at the private markets, and we have to deal with other floods. I mean, other risks. In California, the state insurance commissioner worked out and asked for a moratorium on the insurance companies stopping writing policies, because in some places they wanted to stop because of the fires. And so that was a short-term solution, but we have to deal with a larger one. So again, this is an issue. If you think about the insurance industry and the banks and their regulators, it's affecting them today. And there are some great leaders, both at the state, federal, on the government side, and in the private sector, but not enough. We are way behind where we need to be, and way behind other countries in this work.
I mean, I was generally putting forward a social rights agenda when I when I ran for both the House of Representatives in 2018 and the Senate in 2020. And part of that involved a right to a job at fair wages, in other words, to eliminate unemployment and poverty income with a federal job guarantee. And I felt that that was crucial for making the transition to green energy, because there are people who will lose jobs in this transition, and we have a duty to ensure that they have employment awaiting them, and that is also important politically to lower the boom on fossil fuel exploration, fossil fuel production and consumption. And by the same token, I think that a fundamental human right, as is recognized in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, is the right to decent housing. And you know, I think we have to think about that in terms of not only homelessness, that is, of course, an abiding national problem, but the threat to housing that's presented by climate change. I mean, you speak of one part of that in terms of ensuring that people are not rebuilding where they shouldn't be rebuilding, and providing them with the means to have housing when their housing is destroyed. But I think that's something that in part can involve, you know, regulations of private insurance, but also involves a public sector commitment.
Absolutely. It is a public and private, and you know, it is, as the journalist and author H.L. Mencken said, for every complex problem, there's a simple answer that's always wrong. And you know, this is a very complex problem. So we need to address the underlying risks more. You know, if not, it's estimated that we will have, in our country alone, never mind other countries, in our country alone, we'll have tens of millions of climate migrants, people who either can't live or work where they are now because of floods or fires or hurricanes. And then that puts more pressure on other areas that also is facing pressure from droughts or other areas. So it will affect every part of our country. We need to develop strategies for particular risks like fires and floods and hurricanes and mitigation efforts, but then we also need to have a broader area. And throughout this, Ceres believes that we as a nation need to focus, as President Biden is saying he's going to do, on the environmental justice issues that he has, when he has announced his plans. They've addressed that, you know, 40% of the funds and other kind of benefits are going there. So we think that all of those are important. And there's one group of actors that is just starting to get involved, and that's the financial regulators. The state and federal insurance commissioners, the Federal Reserve, bank commissioners and others, the Securities and Exchange Commission, they're critical to ensure we have a safe country, a sound economy, and a clean economy.
I know that many organizations, such as your own, as well as the Biden administration, are setting goals of carbon neutrality being achieved either by 2040 in the United States and worldwide by 2050, or by 2050 in the United States. And I was myself putting forward a more ambitious goal of 2030 being when the United States would achieve carbon neutrality. That this is like the 10 years that we gave ourselves to get on the moon, and that there's no technological barriers to achieving this, and that what it would amount to would, in a sense, give notice to the fossil fuel industry that by 2030, they have to end all fossil fuel exploration, all fossil fuel production, all fossil fuel consumption, at least those that are going to add to carbon emissions, and that we would have to also provide for, enable people to exchange their fossil fuel appliances and vehicles for green vehicles and appliances of one sort or another. And, you know, as you know, General Motors just recently announced that they are going to be producing only electrical vehicles by 2035. China, where GM and many other car companies sell more cars than anywhere else in the world, China now has a third of the car market. They produce more than half of the batteries for electric vehicles. They produce most of the electric motors in the world. They've set a goal of 2035 for having all vehicles be electric. So I was thinking that we could do that, and although the fossil fuel industry is now suffering the beginnings of contraction, it nonetheless is the richest industry, I think, in human history. And to me, it seems feasible for them to be able to reinvent themselves in the 10 years, and for the petrostates to reinvent themselves in 10 years, and that we have to think about facilitating that transition. I don't know what you think of such measures that could appear very draconian, but to me, they seem that they're feasible.
So we work with companies of all different industries, and I think what we've heard from companies that are, and with some great leadership on some of these companies, that it really depends on the industry. There are some industries that they can get to carbon neutral by 2030, and you know, Apple and Microsoft and others have set these ambitious goals. Microsoft is going to be climate not just neutral, but they're going to be negative. They hope to recapture all the carbon they've used since they were started. So some companies can do that. Other companies, based on whether it be a heavy industry or agriculture, may take a little longer. So we want every company to do this as soon as possible. Our goal is by 2040, but that's also with interim goals. It's not just do nothing until 2039, that it's really every 5 years or so, there has to be a measurable, quantifiable goal to head towards that, setting benchmarks along the way. But some industries can do it faster, and that would be great if they can. And this is one of those areas that momentum does create more momentum. And the more you see companies doing it, it will empower the policymakers and the legislators to think about it. We also support a carbon tax. You know, there's a lot of complexities there, and the environmental justice is one of them, and making sure that people are dealt with in an appropriate and fair way. But that would send a very clear signal to the marketplace.
One of the things about a carbon tax that I've always found a little bit questionable is that it doesn't focus on fossil fuel carbon often. It just speaks in a general way about carbon. But I do think that biofuels have an important role to play in the transition. And they, of course, that they involve carbon, but they don't produce any added carbon. And I don't know if that's taken into account in terms of the carbon tax that you're thinking about.
Well, there are lots of models, and again, we're open to all kinds of conversations about those. And biofuels, many of them are very positive, but some of them, depending on the production, if you look at the full life cycle of those, they can also be impactful for our food diet, for the way some of the ethanol is made, some of the subsidies and that. So biofuels has a place, but in the meantime, we believe there's so much can be, you know, the growth of electric vehicles, the reduction in impact that the major industrials, there are, you know, many sectors we work with. I'll just give you an example of steel, where there's a group working to reduce their emissions in steel and cement and transportation. And then the role of the, as I say, the financial regulators is important as well.
Now, I don't know if you've seen Michael Moore's, at least the film Planet of the Humans by Jeff Gibbs. It was produced by Michael Moore.
I've heard of it. I have not seen it.
Although Gibbs himself was for many years an advocate for green energy, it presents a very skeptical picture of what wind and solar can accomplish on their own, and makes an argument that they cannot possibly replace what is being provided by fossil fuels, both because of difficulties in terms of having a continuous source of energy, given the fact that the sun is not always out and the wind is not blowing, you know, in a constant manner, but also more generally that it's not sufficient. And in terms of the practical solutions, when I was campaigning, I unfortunately had to spend much of my time calling donors, but occasionally I have very interesting conversations with some. And I spoke, for example, to a biologist named Richard Parenteau, who told me about a process, I don't know if you've heard of it, methane pyrolysis, which is a technology that can remove 100% of the carbon from methane, from natural gas, by pushing it through molten metal, which splits the methane molecule into carbon and four hydrogen atoms. And then you can burn the hydrogen for electricity production or use it in cars or in fuel cell vehicles and the like. And it's completely clean. So in a sense, that sort of made me think that there's a part of the fossil fuel production, namely methane, that could actually be used for clean energy and in a way that would be very effective.
Sorry.
And there was one other technology I'll mention in a second, but go on. You had something to say about that.
Well, no. First, I'm not a scientist, so I wouldn't talk about the different technology. I don't know this particular individual, but I do think three things. A, America, there's so many people, creative, entrepreneurs, scientists, come up with new ideas all the time, and that's fantastic. And for cleaner technologies and cleaner industrial processes, cleaner ways to make cement and steel and agriculture and building usage. So I look, that those are really important. Second thing is, there is great development in batteries, but we need to go even further on those. And third is just from a energy, the idea of more distributed generation, more microgrids that would ensure, A, help us from the blackouts that California are seeing, but also ensure that low-income people aren't left behind and those areas. So I think that with all those things, renewables can meet a growing need. But we also need new technologies, and I don't know about this particular one, but interested in those generally.
I mean, there's another one I'll mention. I mean, which is plays a major part in world energy production. That's nuclear power, and also another call. I spoke to someone who was an engineer, and he spoke about a fourth generation nuclear power plant design, which is now beginning to be implemented in no longer experimental models, but actual models. And they have a fail-safe design. They're not pressurized. They use molten salt. They operate in a way where if the core overheats, the expansion that is resulting will automatically clamp down on the reaction. They can use spent fuel. So they provide a solution to that problem. But what do we do with all the spent fuel that has been accumulated? They can't be used for nuclear weapons production because of what they use. And they, in a sense, are renewable because they can use spent fuel to re-engage things. So I think we shouldn't turn our eyes away from nuclear power, which obviously in its current state presents problems of possible meltdown disasters, of nuclear proliferation, but there may well be a different nuclear technology that can solve these problems and could play an important role in ensuring that we can have an adequate supply of green energy. Obviously we can use wind and solar, but we have other things that we can make use of. And that, of course, would have something to do with what is going to be the regulatory framework to allow these kind of technologies to be implemented perhaps around the world.
Right, and there are agencies like FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, and at the state levels, the Public Utility Commission that regulates utilities, that are all critical in setting the rules for this. You know, think about the innovation in the communications field in the last 30 years, when we all, had a rotary landline phone, and today most people, or a growing number of people, just rely on a cell phone that can do more than we ever could imagine computers could. So the same kind of unlocking of technology on the energy side. A lot has been done already, and just Tesla is a great example of that. But I think we're just at the start of this effort.
From reading the materials of Sari's organization, I see that a major concern has to do with the threat to water supplies in much of the world, including the United States, owing to climate change. And obviously this has implications for the economic risks of all sorts of industries and whole populations. And I was wondering what you see needs to be done.
Yeah, so just as we're talking about climate, water is very scarce and getting scarcer. I mean, potable water, and it is more at risk in some areas, because obviously you can't move a body of water from one area to the other. So if a body of water either gets polluted or it dries up, and so we have a whole initiative at Ceres about water, and there are lots of people, if you ever want to have a whole show about that, they could tell you in more detail. But that we're working with many companies that are working to reduce their water usage, some of the consumer product companies we're working with, and they're doing some great work there. But that if we, as a, you know, in a growing population in the world, if we don't reduce our water, we're not going to have enough for everyone. And it's getting worse because, again, there's some areas that are going to be affected because of drought. There are other areas because of floods, but the crops won't be able to grow there. And so we need to find ways to reduce the water, and that's in from the consumer products to what we eat to the manufacturing processes as well. It's a very serious issue.
What kind of regulatory measures do you think could...
I'm not the right person to answer.
Okay.
Sorry.
Yeah.
We do have people at Ceres who can tell you that. Sure. I'm just not that person.
Yeah. I have a question specifically. There seems to be, at least for younger people, a culture around climate change that's forming. I think you could even partly define the younger generation as those who might be at least aware of some sort of climate change and know that they might see real, very, very disastrous effects. Part of the result of that is I think there's young people who are taking a lot of this seriously. One of the reasons why there's great enthusiasm over Tesla in colleges is because of this. There's also a way that the market has taken a hold of some of these trends when it comes to it. I mean, specifically and not limited to people take certain personal choices like driving an electric car or becoming a vegetarian or buying into a very specific group. I just was wondering if you have any comments both on maybe this cultural shift that seems to be happening and maybe how it can be either nefarious or beneficial for the cause.
Oh, we're seeing it all over the world, absolutely. That there is, first is people are seeing the problems more, the flooding, the fires, the studies, and that they understand it is a complex situation and we need to act, and that young people, whether it be, think about Greta from Europe or young people in this country, are standing up. So I am, that gives me optimism to see what they're doing, and that is great, but we need to move faster. And we need all of us to, and it affects everything we do. So as for all of your listeners, you know, when they think about their dollars, their voting is not just when they go to the election, but what products are they buying? And are they asking people about their climate impact? Have they asked their retirement fund, you know, wherever they work? Is there a retirement fund that has a climate focus or ESG, environment, society, and governance focus, and to invest their dollars? What are the products that they're using? And if they make a decision for environmental reasons, are they sharing it on social media with their friends and neighbors and other things? So that, yes, what young people are doing is inspiring, but we also need everyone, whether they're on the board of a local nonprofit, they're running a big company, or they're a sole proprietor, everyone can have an impact in their day-to-day decisions.
Just as a follow-up, you mentioned Greta. I'm sort of taken back to the Sunrise Movement confronting somebody like Nancy Pelosi about it, and sort of, you know, she sort of condescendingly patted the movement on the head and said, well, that can wait, more or less. I guess along that vein, I mean, she became what could be considered an adversary to the climate movement. In what, I mean, whether she is or not, what other, you know, opposition, who are the enemies in this fight besides, I guess, your general oil or gas companies? Who should we be looking out for, more or less?
Well, actually, first, so I do not consider Nancy Pelosi an enemy. I think she has strong leadership. That doesn't mean I agree with every single item, but overall, she's done a lot of great things, and I'm excited about what Congress is going to do going forward. But I think, and I don't look at it as enemies. It's just people who haven't had the chance and haven't made it a focus. And I think that there are many big industrial companies that are heavy energy users that are investing ways, but they're not going fast enough. And you mentioned earlier, Richard mentioned earlier, GM. I want every company to think about what they can do to make a bold statement in that area. Some are doing that, but not enough. So I think that that's the area. And then I think on, you know, some legislators have opposed this. We're nonpartisan, but, you know, more on the Republican side have opposed some of these areas. And we hope that these solutions are bipartisan. I mean, if you look at all the new polls that come out, Pew and others, climate solutions, you go one after the other, there is bipartisan support, 60, 65, 70, 75%, depending on which of the tactics you're talking about. So we hope that there can be those, but it's complicated. And, you know, this requires change in our process. You know, there's an old adage that says that people like progress, they just don't like change. And when you're in the middle of it, it's hard to know which it is. And so as, you know, in the short term, some of these will cost businesses money, some of these changes, but in the long run, it'll assure their stability and give them a new opportunity for growth. So there are lots of challenges, and then a lot also depends by industry.
Now, as you know, I mean, the people in the world who are going to be suffering the greatest danger and economic loss through the increasing climate heating and everything else it involves are people in less affluent nations, and they also are under really great pressure to provide growing energy production to help lift more and more of their people out of poverty. And obviously, they need help from outside, I think, or maybe I shouldn't say obviously, but it seems to me they do need assistance from outside to allow them to grow their energy without having to grow fossil fuel emissions. But I know you're focusing largely on what the private sector can do in the United States. How do you think they can get involved? Or what do you think could be done to have them play a role in this right. kind of facilitation?
Yeah, I think it's an enormous opportunity, both for a greener future. That you know, there are many countries that leapfrogged the telecommunications field, so they never had wires and poles of phone lines to homes, and now many of them have cell phones. And matter of fact, there are some that do more services, more banking on their cell phones than even the United States. So there is a potential that they can leapfrog the technology in the energy field as well. And that's a big business opportunity for many companies in a variety of renewables and battery and microgrids and energy efficiency.
So who's going to provide the investment that will be able to purchase those things?
It's complicated. I mean, so the world needs to do it. Governments need to do it. Businesses need to look, you know, for it as well. But there's no one answer to that question.
Sure.
And it obviously depends a lot on which country, what technology. Some can afford to pay for it, some can't. Some, you know, what is the international banking organizations like the IMF and the World Bank, what are they doing in terms of prioritizing this? But that's another whole area.
Do you have any specific legislative proposals that you would like to see the new Biden administration push through Congress?
Well, before that, there's a lot they can do on a regulatory front. If you look at all the regulatory agencies, the Securities and Exchange Commission, the Federal Reserve, there's a dozen at the federal level. And first is we hope that, President Biden has said in his Build Back Better policies that companies and their suppliers disclose their carbon input. So we have recommended that Securities and Exchange Commission go through a process to establish a mandatory climate disclosure process. That will ensure that every large, medium and large size company has to disclose that, and we can start to track it. Where this has happened in other countries, it's already making an impact. For example, in France, where they've been certain financial institutions, banks, have had to disclose for 4 years. Those banks have reduced their loans to the fossil fuel industry by 40%, that disclosure. So climate disclosure is an important issue, and that's something that does not need legislative approval, that can be done through a regulatory process. And then there's a lot of bank supervision at the Federal Reserve that's also needed. So those are two areas that we believe are priorities and don't need legislative approval.
I mean, one other side to things is the structure of corporate governance in this country. I think we know that in many, many corporations have CEOs and boards of directors who collude with one another, and of course, founders can have their special class of shares and maintain control in various ways. And there's a somewhat alternative model that some countries in Europe have put forward under the slogan of worker co-determination. And basically what it means is that half of the seats on corporate boards of directors are held by the elected representatives of employees. And I was pushing that idea as something that could transform the way in which corporations operate from within, and that I think could have great implications for how they handle such things as their policies to mitigate climate change. What do you think of what ought to be done or not ought to be done regarding the way we allow corporations to be governed?
So we think there are a number of updates that need to be made. I wouldn't necessarily, to be honest, support the recommendation you had made. That I think goes farther, but there's a lot in terms of how the Securities and Exchange Commission allows people to have shareholder votes. We have a whole governance program that works on educating and training directors in things to think about for environment, governance, and social issues, that they should have, every board, for example, should have a climate subcommittee that looks at some of these issues. So we want to make sure that they're getting the right information, that to build these goals into CEO compensation, because that's a big driver. And if the CEO knew that blank percent of his or her compensation was tied to meeting their climate goals, it would be driven harder than it is in some companies. So we think there's a lot of things that can be done more actively at the board level.
One of the fallouts of sort of changing economies like this has been leaving, as you mentioned, particularly the conditions in France, leaving some people feeling disenfranchised about the conditions of their job, that coal miners will not have one anymore. And in France, you could say that the carbon tax and whatnot, these more progressive ideas around climate change wound up sparking the Gilets Jaunes movement. Whether it's entirely the case, it's not exactly there. Are you at all worried about maybe displacement of workers? Would you buy on to maybe considering a federal job guarantee as a way to rectify that?
Again, there are a variety of topics. So the short answer is, yes, we have to very much worry about displacement of workers. And there has to be an orderly transition. And so whether it be workers in the fossil fuel industry or those in other industries, there needs to be time for the companies to make their plans, adjust them, and retrain the staff. Having said that, the clean energy world overall is a net job increase and can add jobs, but we have to build in that transition.
I mean, for me, it was somewhat painful during the presidential debates to see how Trump, and later in terms of the debates for a Senate candidate in Georgia, in this case Kelly Loeffler, putting the Democrat on the spot for not appearing to have measures to deal with the loss of jobs that would come by engaging in any kind of climate mitigation. And, you know, they would over and over again point out how just as in dealing with measures to contain the pandemic, this would involve job losses. And the Democratic candidates didn't have any ready answer, I thought, that was sufficient.
Well, actually, so first is, I want to be clear. Ceres is a nonpartisan organization. So we work with people on both sides, and there are many Republican legislators and organizations that we collaborate with. I think actually President Biden was very clear that this is central to his priorities, not just because of the environmental issues, as you've talked about, the climate issue, but because it is a job creator.
I think it is crucial that it be made clear how no one's jobs will be at risk in the transition, and to have a firm pledge and policy for achieving that. And that will be politically crucial in order for it to get adopted, at least through Congress.
I remember reading an article, I think it was, I don't quite remember, it might have been by NPR or something, talking about before the Senate flipped, how big oil was not particularly worried about the way that Biden might deal with this, not of any fault of his own, but of the ability to sort of backlog it. But now we're looking at, a real potential for Biden to take full stride the promises he made about climate change, which is particularly exciting for those who want to mitigate it like us.
Yes. Yes, I agree with what you said. It's the most ambitious plan. And in the first several days of this new administration, between the appointments he's made, the nominations he's made that need Senate approval, and the executive orders, there's a lot of exciting momentum. But it's still early days, and hopefully find some opportunities to get some climate work through Congress as well.
Right, legislation, get a bill through.
Yeah. And particularly a firm deadline for making the transition.
Well, this was, I think, a very fruitful sharing of ideas. I mean, given sort of the parallels of private and public concerns about this. Stephen, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you both for your time and for all that you're doing. And again, if people have questions, it's CERES, Ceres, CERES.org. And we have a lot of information. We'd love to have you go there and to learn more. But thank you both.
Okay. Thank you, Stephen. Great
thanks.
To meet you.
Bye-bye.